Carolina in the morning.
In Carolina.
No one could be sweeter than my sweetie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading from Growing Up with Chapel Hill, The Village from 1901 to 1925, by Jane Toy Coolidge. Chapter 5. To the Dentist. Life went smoothly in Chapel Hill, week following placid week in familiar succession. Nobody was rich, but nobody was poor either. Luxuries were non-existent, but modest comfort prevailed. Trusted black helpers attended to daily tasks in the house, kitchen, and yard, leaving their employers free to think about other things. But there were some physical problems. Care of the family teeth was one of these, for our dentist lived 12 miles away in Hillsboro. A short trip by car nowadays, but an entirely different proposition in the early 1900s. On the scheduled day, we got up for an early breakfast before the hack from Pickard's livery stable came to drive us to the depot. My mother, my brother, and I, with Frances Venable, if she needed to see the dentist too. At the station, my mother bought round-trip tickets, and we climbed aboard the waiting train. We knew we were in good hands, for the three men who ran the train were our neighbors, Mr. Nesbitt, the engineer, Captain Smith, the conductor, and Mr. Sparrow, the fireman. Mr. Nesbitt had a good head of neat white hair, a handsome gray mustache, round pink cheeks, and a ready smile. His home was just across the street from ours, and the peacocks Mrs. Nesbitt kept were a beautiful sight. Their screams, which sounded like the cries of a female being murdered, were less pleasant. It was said that Mr. Nesbitt came from an affluent family up north, and I wonder now if he may have had a boyish infatuation with trains and run away from home to pursue his dream. If this was so, he had succeeded, in a modest way, in achieving his heart's desire. The engine he drove was small, to be sure, but he was in absolute command, running it skillfully year after year, and presenting to the world the picture of a happy man as he leaned out of the cab window and waved to farmers less pleasantly occupied with humdrum field work. Captain Smith lived up the street from the Baptist church. He was a wiry man in a wrinkled uniform, once dark blue, now a nondescript color, and an impressive, official-looking cap. Mr. Sparrow's house was just behind ours on the back street. He belonged to an Orange County family so numerous and so active in the community that when you spoke of a sparrow, it was assumed that you meant a person, not a member of the winged species. The latter were referred to as sparrow birds. These men were full-time railroaders, but their work schedule allowed them to eat 3 regular meals at home every day. They took the morning train out at 8:30 and brought it back in time for dinner at noon, after which they made a leisurely second trip, returning at supper time. Ordinarily, the train, which we called the Whooper, had one freight car and one passenger coach with cindery red plush seats. On special occasions, such as commencement, the opening of the college term, and big football games, extra coaches were added, making it an impressive sight as it puffed its way over the trestle, whistle-blowing full blast. The trip to University Station took about 30 minutes. It was over all too soon, and we tumbled out to wait for the big mainline train. Besides the station, there was a general store, covered with posters advertising Lydia E. Pinkham's compound, a sure cure for female troubles, Bull Durham tobacco, and numerous kinds of snuff. A grove of woods on one side of the track was a tempting place to explore, and we wandered in its outskirts, looking for a familiar double tree whose big trunk divided into two parts a few feet from the ground, leaving a space in between where there was always water. But we didn't have time to do much investigating. The train roared in, and we climbed aboard. Now we were really traveling, getting a glimpse of the outside world. The big coach filled with unknown travelers going on long journeys, the strange conductor, awesomely official, the water cooler at the end of the car where we could get a drink if we'd thought to bring a collapsible metal cup. These were all exciting, but most thrilling was the news butcher coming down the aisle with the big tray suspended on a leather strap around his neck. On the tray was a fascinating collection of things you could buy if you were lucky enough to have some money. Little flags with names of faraway places on them, bags of popcorn and peanuts, unfamiliar candies and glass pistols, and lanterns filled with sweet little pellets of many colors. But before we could look at them all, the train was slowing down, and we pulled up at the Hillsboro station. Like the depot at home, this station was a long way from town, but a colored man named Bill was waiting with a surrey drawn by his horse, also named Bill, to drive us to the dentist's office. There he said goodbye with a promise to come back in time to take us to the afternoon train, and we climbed a musty flight of stairs to the second floor, our hearts filled with foreboding. There was nothing we could do to put off the awful hour. Here we were, and we had to face it. Dr. Spurgeon was a portly gentleman, gray-haired, dignified, and, to us, elderly. He may have been almost 50. "Any serious trouble, Mrs. Toy?" he would ask, and my mother would describe our symptoms, if any. Then he would take care of us one by one, grinding and packing and tamping down fillings, totally absorbed in his work, with only an occasional grunt. Was it of satisfaction at a good job or perplexity at a new problem? As a comment. And we in the chair sat still until he'd finished. There was no such thing as "that's enough for today." We gritted our figurative teeth and stuck it out. I guess it was tiresome for Dr. Spurgeon, too, but he allowed himself the solace of a wad of tobacco which bulged in his cheek, sending occasional whiffs in our direction. He worked away steadily until a glance at the clock told him it was time to go home to dinner. "Back in an hour," he said, changing his white coat for a dark one. We were free. If my mother was feeling prosperous, we walked down the street to the hotel to have dinner, a treat that made us feel elegant and sophisticated. The hotel was on a main street in an old building with a wide front porch extending all along its front. Later, its historic value would be recognized as an asset and made much of. But in those days, it was just old and respectable. Midday dinner was a hearty meal with plenty of meat and gravy, with vegetables served in little oval individual dishes that looked like bird baths. These clustered around our plates in an impressive array, but the best part of the meal was the dessert. In contrast to the fruit or cake we were apt to have at home, rich and elaborate dishes we'd never heard of, much less tasted, were presented. Of these, the one that impressed me most was molasses pie, and in later years I leafed through cookbooks and queried expert housekeepers in an attempt to reproduce it. Recipes for molasses pie there were, but none of them even slightly resembled the delectable dish I remembered. I wonder now if young taste buds and the thrill of novelty were the main ingredients. If the family pocketbook was a bit flat, and this was the case more often than not, we had brought a picnic lunch, and this we carried across the road to the old Episcopal churchyard. Here, surrounded by ancient gravestones, we ate our sandwiches and tea cakes. These would be called cookies now, but we Southerners hadn't learned the word then. As we watched horses grazing in the wide green fields of the Cameron estate. Standing alone at the far end of the meadow was a huge oak, from whose limbs seven men were hanged in the year 1771 because they had dared to rebel against King George III. They were the leaders of North Carolinians who had the temerity to think they could correct the abusive taxes levied by the English governor, or, as they said, regulate the government. A group of these regulators fought the well-armed British soldiers at the Battle of Alamance and were defeated. Governor Tryon was a hard man, or a strong public servant, according to the way you look at it. The seven men he hanged gave their all, rather than submit to what they believed to be unfair taxation. They were plain, simple men, and they died without knowing that someday their side would win. Looking across the fields at the tall oak, we had the feeling that somehow this was a special kind of place. We were silent for a moment and shivered a little. Then we brushed away the lunch crumbs and made our way back to Dr. Spurgeon's office. Chapter 6. Faith and Works. Chapel Hill was a church-going community. In the early days of the university, it had been customary for professors to be ordained ministers, and even in the late 1800s, several members of the faculty had licenses to preach. Not that they did much of it, but their character set the religious tone of the town. If among them an occasional soul was a free thinker, he kept pretty silent, and his right to his own beliefs was respected by the dignified gentlemen who ran the churches. But, as is often the case, the day-by-day busyness of church work was left to the ladies. One group of these women has left us an account of how they went about it. The minutes of the Ladies' Guild and Auxiliary of the Chapel of the Cross were recorded in a notebook that lay for many years in the bottom drawer of my mother's desk. Here, between worn covers of red imitation leather, the past is embedded like an insect caught in a bed of amber. The meeting of the guild was held on January 6, 1900, at the rectory. Number present, 8. Subject, the Church Periodical Club. Dr. Meade told of its formation, aims, and needs. Mrs. Toy and Mrs. Prince read letters from people who had especially benefited by the organization. Decision was made to pack a box of magazines and other reading matter to send away. Meeting adjourned. A. Linscott, Secretary. 8 ladies in sweeping, full-gored skirts and tight little jackets had picked their way along the muddy village streets to go to that meeting. They left their rubbers on the rectory porch and went into the ministerial parlor to start the work of the new century. The secretary was a methodical woman, from the north, I think, and, determined to improve on the casual ways of her predecessor, had bought a new notebook for the occasion. She wrote the date in red ink at the beginning of the line. The rest of her precise, flawless script was in black. She did not devote a whole page to each meeting. That would have been wasteful. A single blank line served economically to separate the weeks. That first meeting formally started the century on its way, but it was at the next one that things began to happen. January 13, 1900. The regular meeting of the guild was held at the residence of Mrs. Battle. The attendance was good, and many matters of business were brought up. There was the report of the periodical club. 7 regular periodicals have been promised with the postage. Part of the books given were packed by Mrs. Toy and Miss Barbie, and the freight on these was 51 cents. There are enough more to fill 3 boxes. There was a discussion about the church carpet, taking up the pews, and the expenses involved. Mrs. Venable's resignation from her charge of old Mrs. Newman was accepted, and Mrs. Pratt kindly consented to take her place. A question of fines for absence was brought up, but not decided. It was suggested by Mrs. Payne for each member to make 2 garments a year for the orphanage. A. Linscott, Secretary. The ladies had gone to work in earnest. They were doing their duty by the outside world, but they had gotten down to brass tacks at home. Carpet tax, to be exact. The carpet had come into the minutes to stay. It bobbed up at each succeeding meeting until finally, different ladies were appointed to see to the cleaning of the church, and it was decided to send to Durham for a man to put down the carpet. The suggestion was made that each member of the guild be assessed 50 cents to pay for the laying. This was voted upon and carried. Where those 50-cent pieces came from, I do not know. Those women didn't have much cash. In our college town, professors' salaries were unbelievably small. Two or three of the ladies were widows who made meager, if genteel, livings by renting their spare bedrooms to students. Pin money must have been practically non-existent among them, yet somehow those half dollars were saved up and handed to the treasurer, doubtless with grandly casual gestures. The carpet was laid. In 1901, the handwriting in the Red Book changes. A. Linscott's methodical entries are no more. She must have moved away, for her name vanishes from the records. The new secretary did not sign her entries, which were written in a swift, dashing hand, and skimmed lightly over dull routine, but she made up for such omissions by the graphic candor of her reports. Weekly meeting of the guild, held at Mrs. Judge McCrae's. Number present, 13. Aid to old Mrs. Newman discussed whether to continue or discontinue our weekly allowance of 50 cents to her. It was decided to continue it. Mrs. McCrae was asked and agreed, with the assistance of some of the ladies, to try to persuade the old woman to be more cleanly in her habits and dress. Did the ladies visit their aged pensioner, and did they succeed in bettering her way of life? Alas, we cannot know. Having set down their worthy intentions, the secretary rushes on to other things. Mrs. Judge McCrae seems to have stepped forward. There were two Mrs. McCrae's in the guild, hence the use of the distinguishing title. At the next election of officers, she was chosen president. The secretary says, "by a large majority," and accepted the office most gracefully. She was to keep it for many years. Once, it is true, another lady was chosen, but after a few months she moved away, and Mrs. Judge McCrae was again unanimously voted into office, which honor she accepted much to the joy of all members. The feeling of the ladies is evident. Only real charm could have evoked that little burst of secretarial applause. Rarely are the ladies mentioned by name, yet from scanty references repeated throughout the years, their personalities stand out with surprising clarity. It was always certain ones who proposed the practical motions, certain others who brought up fancy new schemes. Three or four names are sure to appear when committees are appointed for honest-to-goodness hard work. Three or four other names pop up when there is gaiety in the air. Mrs. McNider took care of the children's Easter egg hunt. Each spring she brought up the subject, volunteered to dye the eggs, and asked everybody to send a dozen to her house by the Thursday before Easter. Mrs. Toy was interested in books. She it was who always packed the boxes of magazines that were sent to lonely souls in mission outposts. And often, when the guild meeting was devoted to sewing, it is recorded that she entertained the ladies by reading aloud to them an interesting article or story. Mrs. Judge McCrae was gracious and graceful. She seems to have had the knack of keeping the ladies happy and the atmosphere harmonious. The other Mrs. McCrae must have liked to go on trips, for she was always being elected delegate to district meetings and was never too busy to drop everything and go. So, year in and year out, they worked together. They knew each other's weaknesses and strengths. Doubtless, they tried each other's patience at times, but they kept the peace, at least the outward and visible peace recorded in the Red Book. It was the practice of the guild to take orders for catering, and these transactions are faithfully reported. Mrs. Prince cleared 30 cents from a cake for Mrs. Whitehead. Mrs. Cobb reported an order for 35 plates of chicken salad. After some discussion, it was decided to fill this order. Each volunteered a helping hand, and the work was divided out among the members. An order was received for 9 cakes from Mrs. Wheeler, and 1 for preparing the refreshments for the banquet on University Day. This was big business, and the president marshaled her forces for the attack. Mrs. Pratt and Mrs. Mangum to see about all dishes, glass, and silver. Mrs. Payne to make punch. Mrs. Graves, and Miss Mary Manning to make beaten biscuit. Mrs. Jones and Mrs. Venable to fix celery and lettuce for the salad. Mrs. Toy, Mrs. Venable, Mrs. Graves, and Mrs. Prince to have chickens killed, dressed, and prepared for salad. What scurrying there must have been in kitchens and pantries! What piling high of trays covered with big white napkins! I hope the ladies made a lot of money. In the excitement of the moment, or the weariness that followed, the secretary forgot to mention this. But money must have come into the treasury, for it was always going out. The appeals that are listed are innumerable, and rare indeed was the occasion when the guild did not respond with a contribution. Their donations were modest, but they were multitudinous, and they sped to the four corners of the earth. At one time, Mrs. Judge McCrae seems to have been a trifle concerned about this far-flung beneficence. In January 1906, the secretary notes, "The president said she wanted the guild to help in some way to relieve the poor and needy right around us." So special committees were organized to serve by weeks in rotation, and the ladies took turns in proving that charity begins at home. Each Christmas there was a present for the rector, a good, substantial gift that must have made quite a dent in the treasury. Thumbing through the years, I see that he received, from time to time, a rug, a smoking jacket, a down quilt, and an overcoat. It sounds as if the rectory was chilly, or maybe it was just that the rector was a frail old gentleman who looked cold. But it is true that the rectory always seemed to need repairs. The references are legion, until finally at one meeting, the only talk was about improvements to the rectory. It was decided to have one room fixed thoroughly at a time. Even under this modest and sensible arrangement, the job stretched through the years, during all of which time the missionary appeals kept coming in, and the organist was paid $1 a Sunday. No wonder the ladies sold cakes and beaten biscuit and chicken salad. They made shirt waists, too, and aprons, and fancy articles, which were put in a big basket and sent from house to house to be sold. Later, they had bazaars. Unceasingly, they labored to raise money, and the story of their efforts was faithfully set down in the Red Book. Other things were recorded, too. "The Guild wishes to place on record its profound sense of loss in the death of Mrs. Graham. Mrs. Graham was a tower of strength, whether in our councils or in any labor undertaken by us. She gave her best always, and we feel that her life and work will continue to be a help and inspiration to us." The membership was small, and death did not come often. When it came, the loss was real, and the grief sincere. The little In Memoriams, copied so carefully, are no mere routine fulfillments of courtesy. They are the laments of grieving hearts. Year after year, the record goes on. At last, "Mrs. Judge McCrae gave in her resignation as president, and this was received with greatest regret by every member." She was an old lady now, and it was time for someone else to take over the reins. The town was growing, and the guild was larger and more affluent. 30- and 51-cent items were not accorded the emphasis formerly theirs. There was a sinking fund in the bank, and it mounted into hundreds. Then it was spent. New windows were needed for the church, and this was felt to be a worthy object. But the ladies were not going to let their hard-earned dollars slip lightly through their fingers. The man who undertook the job must have sensed this, for the secretary writes, "After investigation, it was found that amber glass would cost no more than white, so this was decided on, but the contractor hinted that he would rather deal with one man than several women, so it was resolved to ask Mr. Patterson to represent the guild." This was in May 1917. No regular meetings were held during the summer, but there is one entry in July. "There was a meeting of the guild at 4 p.m., This was mainly for the discussion and inspection of the new windows in the church." That is all. The writer broke off abruptly without even a final period. Across the Atlantic, a war was going on. and perhaps the minutes of the Ladies' Guild and Auxiliary didn't seem quite as important as they once had been. The red book was discarded. Nobody wanted it. Its time was over, its work accomplished. Yet somehow not one of the ladies into whose hands it later fell could bring herself to throw it away. Nor can I. Chapter 7. The Dances. A child's memories are like the pictures made by a kaleidoscope, bright fragments of color haphazardly tumbled together. For a little girl in Chapel Hill, some of these bright fragments had to do with the college balls held at commencement, and referred to as the dances. For the 2 days devoted to the dances every June, the campus became not a seat of learning, but a glamorous stage where bows and bells revelled in a whirl of gaiety. The University of North Carolina was a school for gentlemen, and the old Southern code of gentlemanly conduct prevailed. There were rules, unspoken but nonetheless honored, of social behavior, rules laid down by tradition and zealously maintained year after year. Fraternities were the social arbiters, and their power was absolute. If there was snobbishness, there were also high principles of conduct carried out by fine young men, some of whom were destined to become leaders in state government and industry. Non-fraternity men withstood the system, and many of these, too, became leaders on the campus and in the wider arenas of later years. But during the dances, fraternity men held sway, joined together in the German club, which was officially in charge of everything. Tradition was strictly followed, and though high spirits caused some questionable escapades, there was an atmosphere of stylized elegance. Of course, invitations to the dances were at a premium among young ladies all over the state. Such invitations promised 2 days of glamorous pleasure spiced with all imaginable thrills, and they conferred on lucky recipients the status of acknowledged belles. No wonder bids were strenuously sought after and wangled for with all the wiles known to womankind. To a little girl living in Chapel Hill, there was something magical about the dances. Excitement was so thick in the air that even children breathed it in. We knew about dancing because we'd been taken at an early age to a dancing class under the direction of Miss Louise and Miss Canty Venable, and now the beruffled little girls and Eton-collared boys who were members of the class were allowed to go to the afternoon dance that opened the festivities. This was held in Commons Hall, a long, low, brown wooden building on the southwest edge of the campus. Ordinarily, this served as the students' dining room, a drab place haunted by the ghosts of last year's meals. But now, lavishly festooned with blue and white streamers, it was an enchanted palace. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.